This is the IBJ Podcast. I'm Mason King. Okay, I'm going to start this episode of the podcast with a list of seemingly random things that we see and use all the time. Here we go. Wristwatch, crockpot, dishwasher, automobile, stereo speaker, insulin pump, home security system, thermostat. Okay, so here's a 21st century commonality in these products. These and really countless other products have the potential to be connected to the internet. If they're enabled for this, we can control them remotely. They can collect data on their environments and how they're being used and then report back to us with that data. Now, this connection between products and the web is known very broadly as the Internet of Things, or as they say in the industry, IoT. And remember that, IoT, because we're going to say that a lot in the next 20 minutes. And everybody from backpack-carrying entrepreneurs to trillion-dollar companies are trying to figure out the best ways to exploit and evolve this technology. Early in 2018, the city of Fishers and the Launch Fishers co-working space for entrepreneurs teamed up to launch the Indiana IoT Lab. And simply put, it's a tricked-out working space where entrepreneurs, companies, and public institutions can make their IoT ideas come to life and maybe even collaborate along the way. Now, the first tenants moved in about a year ago, and already the lab, which is about the size of a small supermarket, would you guys say that's about right?
Mm-hmm.
About an Aldi or a small Marsh?
Yeah.
Is completely full with dozens of members and tenants. We're at the lab today with two of its leading lights to discuss what's going on here and why it's important to Central Indiana. First, we have John Wexler, founder and CEO of both Launch Fishers and the IoT Lab. John, thanks for having us today.
Thank you, Mason. Thanks for coming.
And we have John McDonald, the CEO of Clear Object, an IoT integration firm and one of the anchor tenants here in the lab. John M. also was instrumental in the creation of the lab.
Yeah.
John, thanks for helping today.
Glad to be here. Two Johns in the podcast today. As I like to joke, one of us is more intelligent and the other one's more attractive.
We'll let you decide.
Nobody cares about this. My first name also is John. I don't broadcast this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I'll be the more attractive and the dumbest one.
Okay.
John, let me start with you. Now, I gave a very elementary and shallow definition of IoT at the top that just kind of focused on consumer technology.
Sure.
Can you fill that out and give me a sense of the enormity of its potential and how it is going to impact our lives?
Yeah, I love telling stories, so I'll tell one to explain. There's a small company in northern Indiana called SCP Products. They make igniters that go in gas stoves. You have one, I'm sure, and everyone does. Been doing it the same way for about 26 years. Got a call from the CEO of that company not too long ago, and he said, "We're bidding on a contract to supply these to a big global manufacturer of these things for the next decade." And I said, "Congratulations." He says, "No, there's a problem. Problem is they want us to put a sensor in the igniter that will talk to the circuit board that it plugs into, because what they want to do is send you a box with a new igniter in it because your stove called and said it needs a new igniter." Mm. And he goes, "Well, can you help me with that?" And I said quite flatly, "I hope so."
Right. Not just because that's what I hope that our team does, because that's what we do, but also because what if I can't?
And some company in Ohio figures that out, or some igniter company in California or China does. The reality is he's not going to be making igniters in Auburn for 27 years. And it means that this little tiny company in Auburn that makes igniters is now an Internet of Things company. And the reality is they all are. Mm-hmm. Every single company has to figure out how to create digital products that right now are differentiating the physical products they have in the marketplace, but in time may in fact become the product. And that is like a fluorescent light that's sort of flickering before it comes on bright all over Indiana, all over the Midwest, all over the country, as people are figuring out what this guy did about what his future really is in data.
This sounds like it's a trillion-dollar business. Is it there yet, or?
There's no question. There are analysts that forecast to be a multi-trillion-dollar industry just in a handful of years into the future. It's substantial.
What is a really important application that just a company would be using internally?
Well, most of the companies that we work with are manufacturing companies, transportation logistics companies, or agricultural companies, or as we like to shorthand here, make, move, and grow. Those companies are already the owners of most of the means of production for the product that they have, and they're often the designers of that product as well in the marketplace. And so they have every tool at their disposal to be able to figure out how to add data, both to the product or about the how the product is developed.
Can you give an example of industrial use for this?
Certainly. There is a company that we work with that produces car radios. These are devices that when I was in high school was a silver box with two knobs in it. This company to give you an example, the Lockheed Martin F-22 Raptor, which was a device largely conceived of in the late 1970s, has about 1.7 million lines of software code in it, which was a lot of software for something of that era. You fast forward to the late 1990s, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, that's when that was designed, has about 6.5 million lines of software code in its avionics and control systems, which is a big jump in software in a short period of time. But the 2019 Mercedes-Benz S-Class 550 has 20 million lines of software code in it, 14 million of which are in the radio alone, making it the most sophisticated device that most people will handle on a daily basis and has to boot successfully 2 seconds every time you turn the power on. That's a lot of smarts, and that's generating a lot of data. It generates a lot of code. A lot of code that has to be maintained by this company. But really, it's that code and the data coming from the product that is the product differentiator, because if it didn't have any of that, it would just be a silver box with two knobs on it, right? It's the software and the data that makes it a radio. And that's that idea of that data and the software becoming more of what the identity of the product actually is, which is a major shift in how things are done.
There are really two distinct markets in IoT, many obviously sub-markets, but the consumer side is what you hear an awful lot about. It's really cool, this neat new thermostat on the wall. But the industrial IoT market, known as Industry 4.0 amongst the industrial community, that is a gigantic market, and that's where an awful lot of IoT spending will occur over the coming decade or so.
Mm-hmm. So we have this lab. Is everybody here just trying to make the next Fitbit? Or I get the impression that they're really coming at this, the different folks here, at different angles. Mm-hmm. Like, give me a couple examples of what people are doing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, very much so. A lot of different types of projects, a lot of different types of companies. I mean, we have Roche that has an innovation team in here doing design sprints on diabetes care tools, right? And so they spend an awful lot of time in our design thinking lab, running sprints and running through the process of thinking about their customer. We have a startup that's focused on machine learning and machine vision for security, so much so that they're building their own cameras to get the highest fidelity components that they need to allow them to see what's going on in an environment. So we have, every imaginable. We have a home automation company that's just, straight up things to make your home more comfortable and work better for you. We have another version of home automation focused on artificial intelligence. And so we are building the smartest home right here in the lab as a showcase for smart home technologies. This company is using algorithms to determine your patterns as you come home, right? If you come home every Monday through Wednesday at 5:15 and you flip a light on, put your favorite music on, you may make a drink in your soda stream, et cetera, et cetera. You have a series of things that you do. As it starts to identify patterns, it's going to ask you, should I remember this scene so that I can automate it later? And then the idea is the smart home will begin to adapt to your uses, and we're going to demonstrate all that technology here.
And they all need to be web-enabled. They all need to be interconnected via...
Definitely. Yeah, and a lot of that's wireless. So we have a lot of expertise here in Bluetooth, low energy, Zigbee, the protocols that allow these devices to communicate in short range. And then also on a large scale with 5G and LoRaWAN, we have several networks that are here making this one of the most connected places probably in the state.
I think
we have
a plane circle around ahead. They think this is a radio tower in the middle of the night.
So. Well, that was one of my questions, was like, so what's your internet bill? What's your internet service bill every month?
These devices are not really bandwidth hogs, right? So if you think about a sensor on a bridge, that's going over the interstate and the traffic on 116th here, if the city wants to monitor that bridge temperature, it's very simply every minute, it just sends up a very 16-character, message that says, this is my location and this is the temperature. Next minute, it does the same. And so you're talking about very, very, it's not streaming YouTube videos, you know, for hours on end. This is just a very little burst of information. So the bandwidth requirements in the IoT world are actually very light touches.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's not, even though I walk through here and I see a lot of people on laptops, they're not all playing World of Warcraft.
Yes.
Some of them might be.
Some of them could.
Fortnite. They're all into Fortnite right now.
But. So, John, you mentioned, what was it, that three-part phrase that you had?
Make, move, and grow.
Make, move, and grow. I feel like that's something, that's like the motto of the state of Indiana right now.
Oh, yeah.
And where we are particularly mixed up in manufacturing and agriculture.
Yeah.
So why is IoT specifically vital? I'll say vital. To the future of Indiana.
Right. Well, those are the three industries that are being most changed by data at the core. Mm-hmm. You talk about Cummins Engine earlier. There's a system that we built for them that they use to collect fault code data from engines. Usually these are emissions related, which can happen just by going up and down a hill or into a wet area or dry area. And when they get too far out of whack, the EPA will make them do what's called derate the engine, which is to lower its power, which is really bad if you're a fleet operator. So the truck driver doesn't really know what these fault codes mean, but Cummins does. So whenever one of these things happens, those messages are collected, processed, and sent back to the fleet operator and the driver to tell them what it is that they should do about it, like pull over and stop or wait till the next service interval. Or they can even pre-roll parts through their internal network and intercept the truck at the nearest Cummins care facility much more rapidly and get it back on the road. So it wouldn't surprise you to learn that Cummins is winning a lot of business in the marketplace because they have this product capability, this digital product. But what might surprise you to realize is that they're not winning it based on the traditional measures of success in the marketplace, like torque or reliability. In other words, they are differentiating their engine in the marketplace in a new way based on the data stream that it's producing, right? And if you let your mind go with that for a little bit, you could see a day not too far in the future that if Cummins is really good at that, they might be able to do that for engines they didn't even make. In fact, if you push a little bit harder on that, you might even see a day where they could stop making engines. And so the production and who actually makes them, if they were really that good, in fact, you could see a day where the data is the product. And so I'm not saying that that's what they're going to do, but it sort of lights a lamp into the future for a lot of these businesses, right? It's not just about being able to differentiate your product. That's true. Mm-hmm. But eventually the value of the data is as much or even perhaps more than the value of the actual physical product.
How about agriculture? I mean, that to me still seems like, you know, the kind of industry where a guy goes out with his cow into the field and plows.
Yeah, it's very technologically oriented already, as any farmer would tell you, and very economically sensitive, as any farmer would tell you as well. But what's interesting is the farm, if you will, is really just a factory floor that happens to be outside. The production they're producing isn't cars or widgets, it's corn. Right, but the metaphor still holds. But it's very low instrumented factory floor compared to what's happening in a car manufacturer. Right, our friends from Beck's Hybrids are well known for taking pictures of fields before the season to be able to program planters to get the right mixture of seed corn in the different places that it needs to go in the field. And of course, at the end of the season, there's a combine that'll roll over it and pick up, you know, corn. You can measure how much yield you're getting live on spot by spot basis. But that's kind of it, right? Other than taking soil samples along the way or whatever, that's about all the instrumentation that we do. And that's, if you applied that to another industry like car manufacturing, that'd be something like going to the factory floor before everybody showed up for the first shift on April 1st, taking a picture of the factory floor, and then waiting until after everybody leaves the last shift on October 31st, taking a second picture, and by comparing the two pictures, figure out how well you did making cars, right? That's kind of how it works, right?
Yeah.
So it's very, very low instrumentation. This is an opportunity for Indiana. It really is. Because a lot of the big equipment manufacturers, the John Deere's of the world, definitely been doing all kinds of work in, you know, autonomous tractors and the like, and that's all great. But the instrumentation of the factory floor as an agricultural factory is a wide open field, metaphor intended, right? Pun intended. And this is a place where Indiana could lead. Right, it's a place where we don't find ourselves behind other places and states right now because we're not. Doesn't mean we're going to be able to stick the landing, as I like to say, on the opportunity, but it is an opportunity. And hopefully we can do more to try and exploit it.
Well, and the real threat there is that as our jobs are automated on the plant floor and in the distribution centers, Indiana is already number one in I didn't even know this existed until a couple of weeks ago. There's a robotics index in terms of percentage of jobs that are automated, and we're number one. Right? That ought to scare us because that's a glimpse into the future, right? As those jobs are automated, the best case scenario for us, they're going to be automated no matter what, but the best case scenario is they're automated with our technologies, right? It reasons that those that do the manufacturing, the distribution, the agriculture enterprises, they ought to be best suited to identify the opportunities to automate. So therein lies the reason this lab and labs like this around the state are going to become very important, because it's our hope that we can take the manufacturing expertise that exists here and ask the question, how can we automate this? How can we build a digital equivalent to this product? How can we automate future, you know, iterations of this? I can tell you that John and I and several others along with Mayor Fadness and some other leaders in the state have traveled around to visit with manufacturing, ag, distribution companies. And as we ask them about what the automation looks like in their plants, and you see these machines, none of them are made in Indiana. Mm-hmm. You know, they come from Italy, and they come from Japan, and they come from all over the place. And we think this is a great opportunity for us to leapfrog into the future by using IoT as the secret weapon to automate what's going on the plant floor.
And when we say using IoT as a secret weapon, what does that mean exactly?
Using IoT to automate what's going on the plant floor. So when you look at a PLC that's running around grabbing parts and delivering
what's a PLC?
A programmable logic controller. One of the trips that we took was to a huge industrial bakery here in Indiana, and they make all of the buns for a region's worth of McDonald's, right? That's a lot of buns, okay? And as we walk through, you would expect to see some pretty cool automation in this plant. And we were kind of blown away that it was just the opposite. John actually asked the question on this tour of who's the highest paid person on the plant? Who's the most, you know, valuable? If this person were gone tomorrow, would create a big problem for you? And the plant manager points over to a guy that's doing the mixing of the recipe, the dough. And he is quite literally, I mean, maybe it's not quite this bad, but it was like a pinch of this, a dab of that, and a little
scoop
of this.
Of the other thing.
And we thought, for sure that's like automated, but no, it was actually a highly manual process by which they make their batches of dough, and then they go into these huge, you know, kneading operations, and then they let them rise, and it was really cool to see. But the reality is, I think the most automation we saw there was on the carousel that warms the buns to let them, you know, finish up.
And on that same trip, John, you'll recall that we went and visited a manufacturer make microscopic plastic parts, injection molded, like little gears, little tubes, that sort of thing, used in implantable medical devices and the like. On a set of highly sophisticated machines that they brought from Japan to do this. What's interesting is they spend all day long kind of cleaning, fixing, tinkering, adjusting the machines, and then shut off the lights and go home. And then these machines turn out these gears and stuff by the millions at night while they sleep. They do this with like eight people, four of which are just Shelbyville High School grads. Didn't even go to college for this, if you even could, right? And so the juxtaposition of this is astonishing, because on one side of the freeway, you have this bun plant that John talks about, built in 78, and all the equipment's original, including some of the people, I think. And then across the freeway, you've got this factory turning out these microscopic gears with high school kids. Here's the thing, and this should be a warning sign or warning call to people who are listening to this podcast. If somebody decided to open a bun factory in Illinois that has even the smallest amount of automation, right, and could produce the buns 2 cents cheaper, how long are they going to be making buns in Shelbyville? But that guy making gears can do it as long as he damn well wants. What you see there is both the past and the future of manufacturing in Indiana, literally within shouting distance of each other. And we got to get people looking more like that gear manufacturer and less like that bun manufacturer in order to have a manufacturing base here in Indiana. Right.
And we talk all the time about automation, but just to make sure I get this, the wrinkle here that we're talking about is internet connectivity. to automation, and that is what you guys are.
It's a major component of it.
Yeah,
I would say machine to machine is the way I'd look at IoT. Right, it might be that a machine on the plant floor talks to another machine, and they might all stay local. They might not actually ever hit the internet, but they use internet protocols and internet-like communication technologies. But it's all about machine to machine, which speeds the process up dramatically. The one other thing I want to throw out there, just as a make sure you Google this and read about this if you are listening to this podcast, is the importance of AI and machine learning in the future.
And you mean artificial intelligence?
Artificial intelligence, yes, and machine learning. Machine learning in particular, right, and AI, because the amount of data that is being thrown off in this IoT world is so overwhelming that it surpasses the human's ability to even analyze and assess what's going on.
And when you say thrown off, how is that?
Well, think about these trucks that John talks about and all the fault codes that are beginning to generate out of a rolling semi. It's surpassing the ability of the human operator or a human back at the base of operations to assess what's going on. So you have to write rules and actions based on the data. So if we see that 80% of our lights in a particular facility are doing one thing, then take this action. You know, if the temperature drops below, you know, negative 15 and this happens, then do this, right? You just, it's a lot of logic and a lot of rules-based decision-making that then enables machines to make decisions for us. And, you know, arguably, the singularity is upon us, right? I mean, you look at Ray Kurzweil, you know, forecasting many, many years ago that a couple of decades in the future, the intelligence of the machines and the machine learning going on will actually surpass humans' abilities. So it's an interesting challenge as this AI and machine learning really grows up.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the lab, it is essentially fully occupied now. What does that look like? How many people are here? How many different companies?
So different companies, I think we're just under 20. And we have room for a few more of what we call the individual member spots. But we have, I'd say, 130 maybe is the number of members that kind of come and go on a regular basis. Just like any work environment, maybe 70% of your people show up on any given day. But we also have public events. Last year in 2018, we had over 3,000 people come through the doors for everything from classes on robotics to IoT meetups. We had a grand opening that pulled in a significant number of people just to check out the facility. So we think an awful lot of this is really about education and the programming to support the IoT economy. And I think as we move forward, you look at our role in all this. One is having the place and the oscilloscopes and the soldering irons and the maker components of the IoT economy. But us doing a class on robotics and hitting 25 to 50 high school and college age kids and sparking a passion in them for this in the future may very well be our secret weapon. Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, and as we saw when we took a brief tour here, you have a lot of pre-existing companies. This isn't so much like a co-working space for entrepreneurs where everyone is just starting off. You have Roche, you have Indiana University, Allegion. Why did they decide, say, well, this particular part of our operations we need to do over there? Over in this Fisher's office park?
You know, I think there are a couple reasons people do that. One is the obvious that they see the importance of supporting a movement like this and want to be part of it almost from the beginning. Second is when you take your teams out of their work environments, you interrupt their rhythms. And innovation is so much about thinking differently about problems maybe that you see every day. And so I know that's the case with several teams. We had a design thinking session in here with Allegion, and they left after a day with progress that they confessed might have taken them much longer in their own environment. And we're talking down to physical prototypes, right, where you take foam and paper and cardboard and paper clips and make a prototype of something. Getting out of your environment is a good way to innovate.
Technology moves so fast. Is this place going to be a different place 2 years from now?
There is no question.
It's going to be a different place 20 minutes from now. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, I mean, technology is a weird business, and that anything that you do right now, sometime between tomorrow and 5 years from now, is utterly obsolete. How do you keep up with that? You can't teach someone technology. The only thing you can do is teach them to be a technologist, right? You can't teach someone to build a business plan. The only thing you can do is teach them to be an entrepreneur.
And if we're not different in 2 years, we've definitely done something wrong. I'll tell you that we've changed just in the last 2 hours, right? John and I had a great discussion this morning about what the go forward looks like with Clear Object here at the lab. And I can easily foresee a time where, you know, our relationship looks a little different than just having developers working here. Maybe we're partners in programming, showcasing technology, and doing some really cool things around IoT that's different than maybe what we've done in the last year. And so, you know, just really in the last couple of hours, you know, we've had discussions that will change the future. And that happens every day here at the IoT lab.
All right, I'll come back in 2 years and we'll talk about it.
All right, great. Hope for that.
Guys, thanks so much. We have to stop right there. But this is super illuminating. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure to be here today, and hopefully folks will take this and listen to it and say, I need to be wondering what I'm doing with my own company about this future, because that's really what the question is. The data is the great creator and destroyer of all business value going forward. And if you don't think that that's a fact, you test me on that. And your relationship to that fact governs your next move.
Thanks so much for coming. I would encourage listeners to pay us a visit. We're open every day. Somebody that wants to come up and walk through the lab and see for themselves what the makerspace looks like, what the oscilloscopes and soldering irons can do for their businesses or their ideas. We'd love to have people come out and pay us a visit, but thanks for coming.
Right on. Talk to you soon. My thanks again to Mr. Wexler and Mr. McDonald. If you'd like more information about the IoT lab and what happens there on a day-to-day basis, Anthony Shetley breaks it all down for you in a story in this week's print edition of IBJ. And one thing we didn't talk about with John and John is how the lab can help entrepreneurs make connections with investment capital, but Anthony has it covered. Speaking of makers and distributors, Sam Quinn explains how the city of Westfield is trying to hang its hat on the advanced manufacturing sector. And by that, we mean the use of innovative technology to improve products or processes. One of Westfield's biggest strengths is the amount of available land for large plants. And IBJ's Susan Orr has a lowdown on the final leg of the I-69 expansion running from Martinsville to Indianapolis. The price of progress will include total closure of a segment of State Road 37 for an indeterminate amount of time and acquiring hundreds of parcels of real estate. Now, you can see all these stories in this week's print edition, which you undoubtedly have delivered to your home and office, or online at IBJ.com. Remember, if you want full and unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning content, just click the subscribe button. As always, thanks for making time for the IBJ podcast in your day. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back again next week.